From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. For decades, until 2013, Indiana's Dick Lugar was a fixture in the U.S. Senate. Steady, prominent, productive. Then he lost to a Tea Party challenger from his own Republican Party, picked off from the right. But Lugar, senator for 36 years, is still watching very closely the paralysis, the rigid party lines, and the unaddressed issues that need addressing. This hour on Point, former Senator Dick Lugar on a world of challenges, terror, surveillance, nukes, the home front, and the urgency of some bipartisanship to take those challenges on. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Does bipartisanship just sound antique to you? Can we have it? Do you want it? On what? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we'll break down the expiration of key provisions of the Patriot Act. But first, joining me from Washington, former Republican U.S. Senator from Indiana, Richard Lugar, now president of the Lugar Center, focusing on food and energy security, the nonproliferation of nuclear weapons of mass destruction, and on effective bipartisan governance. Last week, the Center, with the McCourt School of Public Policy at Georgetown University, released the Bipartisanship Index. Taking a close look at Congress today, Senator Richard Lugar. Dick Lugar, welcome to On Point. Thank you for being here.
Tom, great to be with you.
A lot of people are going to hear you're working on a problem with bipartisanship, and there may be some no-duh out there. We know that there's not bipartisanship in Washington. Do we need a study to figure that out?
Well, unrelenting partisanship has led now to the breakdown of normal spending and budget procedures to some of the least productive Congresses in modern history. And the traditional bipartisanship cooperation on foreign policy has been missing. Thus, the public is recording frequently that these Congresses, the last three at least, have had very little favor. That is, if you're asking approval or disapproval, the disapproval is way out high above the approvals, and this seems to be a growing trend.
So Congress is not popular, but if you strip it down to what really matters for the country, does it matter? Are we getting in trouble because of this lack of bipartisanship?
We are, because essentially members of Congress come to the Congress, represent their constituents, and they do this by drafting bills, legislation. Sometimes legislation deals with budgets, sometimes with foreign policy, sometimes with roads and highways and education and lots of other things. This means somebody really has to take some time to draft a bill. Now, in order to be effective, the member must find other people to support the bill. Usually he may or she may look at members of their party, but increasingly, in order to get legislation passed through two houses, and this is particularly true in the Senate, you frequently need 60 votes, not just a majority. This means almost inevitably that you have to look across the aisle. Now, this doesn't mean people will give up their party membership, that they stop being partisan on many occasions, but it does mean that there is a need, if you're going to have constructive legislation, for people who know what they're doing. And that means drafting good legislation and then reaching out, getting the bipartisan support, and then being prepared to get a time on the floor to pass your bill.
You're trying, it looks to me, Senator Lugar, to build some pressure on members of Congress to do exactly that, to reach across the aisle, to find bipartisan sponsorship, co-sponsorship for legislation that they produce, and measure them, judge them, rank and rate them on that basis. Are you hoping to build some counter pressure to the forces that are pushing people toward polarization?
Yes, clearly we are attempting to do that. Right now, in politics in America, huge amount of money is being spent, sometimes in partisan campaigns, but frequently by special interest groups who have their own scorecards, in quotes. And they're looking specifically at votes that influence their particular interests. And they give money, in large sums of money, to candidates who happen to score well on their, they do the other side. They try to defeat people who do not measure up to that. Now, essentially, there has not been any countervailing situation on behalf of the public as a whole. We're offering, as you suggest, a very strong incentive by listing members from 1 to 100 in the Senate and 1 to 435 in the House in order of their ability to draft bills, to get members on the opposite side, that is the other party, to co-sponsor the bills. In other words, who are the effective persons? And we're listing them very clearly in that respect. The bipartisan index, which can be seen on the website of alugarcenter.org, lists, first of all the members in alphabetical order of their names and gives where their rank is. Then it gives the rank itself so that it's very clear who is who. And I would just say that subsequent to that, in the last few days, that many newspapers all over the country have been publishing the results specifically of members from their district or their state. They're holding them accountable, and members are having to respond to why are you number one or why are you number 75.
You know, I would love to think, Senator, that American voters will reward political representatives in Washington for doing well on your index. But I don't know if that's true. I mean, possibly they will. But on the other hand, bipartisanship itself hasn't got quite the luster perhaps it once did. You yourself got punished by your Indiana electorate. You were famous for working across the aisle, and you had a Tea Party challenger in the primary there who got the better of you. Are you sure that Americans will reward people who reach across the aisle?
No, I'm not certain of that, and you make a very good point. I am certain, however, that if there are not constructive members, and a lot of them in Congress, we are not going to have good laws. We are literally not going to have the kind of foreign policy that comes with the checks and balances with the president back and forth. In other words, the incentives for good government are incentives for the progress of the American people. Now, people may not appreciate this immediately, but I would just simply say that members of Congress have to have a degree of statesmanship. They have to have certainly a degree of looking toward the future for themselves and their children and their grandchildren. In other words, the reason people enter politics, hopefully, is they want to do some good. They want to make a difference in the life of this country.
Let's go to our callers. Anthony in Richmond, Virginia. You're on the air with former Senator Dick Lugar.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to say that I, for one, am glad there is gridlock in Congress. I think what the senator is saying is based on the worldview that unless government is doing something, then nothing is getting done. I think we need to move away from that mentality and return power back to the people. I think the way that our government is going with uncontrolled spending, massive expansion of government intrusion in life with Obamacare, I would mention, the ignoring of our laws. We need people who are going to get in there and stop these things. And if that means government not doing anything, I'm totally fine with that. If that means shutting down the government, that doesn't affect me. I live my own life. I'm independent. I think people should move toward a mentality of being independent of government and government doing less. So I'm just fine with the gridlock.
Anthony, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Dick Lugar, that may be a considerable chunk of the perspective that leaned against you in Indiana a few years back. What do you say to Anthony's view of the world? He's just fine with gridlock. He doesn't want bipartisanship. Let government be paralyzed.
Well, I would say to Anthony that most people, even though they don't want too much government, would, in fact, like to have a country in which there are more jobs, in which there is economic growth, the ability, therefore, for us to provide repair for our highways, to, in fact, to do a good number of things as we prepare, at least, for floods and catastrophes. I would say, in addition, that we live in a dangerous world in which we cannot take the position that I go my own way, and I wish the government would stay out of it. There really has to be a United States government that's prepared to meet the challenges of China, of Russia, the problems of the Middle East, all of the hazards that lie in a world of terrorism, one in which we could have cybersecurity that might shut down all of our communication works. governments have to respond quickly to those challenges. Now, that calls for very creative statesmanship, which may not be entirely understood and appreciated, but I would just say that's the nature of the responsibility a member of Congress has.
What about Americans who say, and perhaps Anthony, our caller in Richmond, feels this way or is part of this, no, there's something else going on here. We're fighting over the way we want to be governed. He wants to be governed less. I mean, I hear people these days who speak almost in terms of a kind of political civil war, and they don't want compromise. They want victory for their perspective on how this country ought to run, Senator Lugar.
Certainly, there are many members of Congress who feel that way, as well as their constituents. And this is why a good number of people have been elected to Congress who take the way of no way, my way or the highway. The idea that simply I didn't come really to argue with other members of Congress, quite apart from cooperating with them. I've come simply to make statements, to make speeches, to pronounce this or that. Now, that's fair enough, and perhaps you can make a living doing that sort of thing with many people cheering you on. But that's not governance. That's not really the ability of a democracy to function and to be prepared, really, for the challenges, either economically or politically at the domestic level, quite apart from the challenges from abroad.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with longtime Indiana U.S. Senator Dick Lugar, 36 years in the Senate until 2013, about what's going on the Hill now, the standoff over practically everything there, and if there's a way to bring back bipartisanship, or if that's just history. The Lugar Center has just come out, along with the McCourt School of Public Policy at Georgetown University, with the new Bipartisanship Index. They measure how lawmakers, how often they co-sponsor bills authored by members of the opposite party, how often they attract co-sponsors to their own legislation. Dick Lugar served as chairman of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations from back in the 80s, and again in the noughts. He was ranking member of the Commerce Committee from 07 to 13, chairman of the Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition, Forestry for a long time there, big in looking at nuclear proliferation and securing nuclear weapons and material in the former Soviet Union, a big, big figure in Washington for a long time. In 2012, Dick Lugar lost the Republican Senate primary in Indiana. Here he was conceding to his Tea Party challenger, candidate Richard Murdoch. Even then, Lugar addressing the issue of partisanship in Congress.
We are experiencing deep political divisions in our society right now. And these divisions have stalemated progress in critical areas. But these divisions are not insurmountable. And I believe that people of goodwill, regardless of party, can work together for the benefit of our country.
But here's the guy who beat him in those primaries. In an interview with Fox News, candidate Richard Murdoch explaining how he looks at bipartisanship.
Well, I have a mindset that says bipartisanship ought to consist of Democrats coming to the Republican point of view. You know, I've said many times through this campaign that one of the things I hope to do is to help build a conservative Republican majority in the United States Senate.
And that is the view that won the primary, did not win the election. Murdoch did not end up in the U.S. Senate, his Democratic challenger did. Dick Lugar joins us today from Washington. He's still in there doing the work. In 2016, voters will have options, and Dick Lugar, you've actually ranked a bunch of those folks who are in the Senate right now on their degree of bipartisanship, and it's pretty interesting here. Lindsey Graham, of course, declaring his candidacy today, a pretty high ranking. You were out of 100 senators, you ranked 21st from the top in terms of the best by your lights. Marco Rubio right in the middle of the pack at 52. Then you get down to Bernie Sanders, number 90, not very bipartisan by your index. Rand Paul, 92, less bipartisan, almost pinning the needle for not bipartisan. Ted Cruz, number 97 out of 100. What about the field and the choice that Americans make in 2016 in terms of encouraging more bipartisanship in this country, Senator?
Well, my belief is that the winner of the Republican nomination will finally be somebody who appears to have the ability to reach out to the other party and to get some agreement. Even the statement that you quoted there from my former opponent, Richard Murdoch, says that he wanted to be a Republican and wants the Democrats to become Republicans. Well, one way, I suppose, of doing that is to offer ideas and legislation that are so interesting and compelling that Democrats, in fact, do cross over and co-sponsor what you have to say. Let me just mention one thing. When I was chairman of the Agriculture Committee in the Senate, I come from a farm family. I'm still managing 604 acres out in Indiana. In the New Deal, we were limited to the number of acres of corn and soybeans and wheat that we could plant. My dad strongly rebelled against this all the time that I was a boy.
Mm-hmm.
When I became a senator, I had an opportunity to offer legislation in a bipartisan way. Pat Roberts of Kansas over in the House side was very, very helpful, now the Senator Roberts. In essence, we repealed the freedom, the idea of the New Deal and passed the Freedom to Farm Act, which finally gave to farmers the ability to plant whatever they wanted to plant on their land of corn and beans. So it could not have occurred without there being a very strong bipartisan wave. And I would indicate that I believe we had greater freedom from all of this, that there was, in fact, a situation in which I was a Republican, but Democrats joined me in wanting to rebel against the excesses of the controls of the New Deal.
What's changed in the country that is making that kind of cross-the-aisle conversation and cooperation less common now? What's different?
I think that many voters, and we've heard a little bit of this already this morning, believe that government at the federal level almost inevitably overspends. That we've been running up huge deficits as the country, selling bonds moving on to a situation which is not as bad as the bankruptcy now facing the Greeks and so forth, but tantamount to that. In other words, there has to be some discipline, some control of spending and of government. Likewise, there is a feeling that bureaucracies in government have been overstretched in terms of rulings in the days and lives of people, and that this must be curtailed. I shared those views as a Republican, as a matter of fact. But this takes some doing. It won't change automatically. If you feel strongly about that, as I did, like the Freedom to Farm, you've got to be in a position to offer legislation that makes the change. Now, for the time being, the Congress has been so partisan that, as we recall, the government shut down a couple of years ago simply because no one would give any way, any direction. In essence, we're coming once again to a situation in which we're not passing authorization bills. Those are the bills in which each committee ideally sets forth what will be the parameters of change. We don't pass those except for the Defense Department anymore. Even the appropriation bills, the 12 or 13 we used to pass one after another before the end of the fiscal year. Only a few may get heard. A few may be debated.
Mm-hmm.
There is such gridlock that there is no time to discuss this. The Congress is out of session or somewhere else. My feeling is we need to be in session. We need to do the job on these spending bills one by one if we are to reach the goal that many Americans, and I'm one of them, want to attain of a balanced budget. As a matter of fact, a surplus on occasion, which we had one time. I think this is critical as opposed to simply saying, I'm simply not going to vote at all. I'm not going to move. I'm not going to offer legislation. I'm not going to reach over to get anybody to support me.
Are we adrift without that? Are we in danger? And if so, where? What's the danger?
Well, we have been adrift on many occasions and in many subjects. So one of the problems is that the president then takes what is called executive action. The president, people would say, oversteps the bounds because he believes that something has got to happen, and therefore he's willing to take a chance that the Congress will finally not shoot down his ideas or rebut what he's going to do. Sometimes the president, whoever it is wrong in that respect. The Congress does rebel and tries to take retaliatory action. But it's a recognition of the factor that in a sense of governance in a democracy, somebody has to make decisions. Somebody really has to take a look at the world as it is now, today, as well as in the future. And this can be the Congress, ideally. Now, it has not been on most occasions recently. Very few constructive pieces of legislation have passed in the last 6 years, for that matter.
It sounds like you're sympathetic to Barack Obama when he's taken some of these executive measures.
Well, I am in the sense that I believe that if a president, whether it be Barack Obama or anybody else, had not taken action, that there would have been great suffering in the country. And there would have been then a call for who's responsible for this? Why is there such a tragic set of circumstances?
Let's go to Robert in Columbia, South Carolina. Robert, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. One of your previous callers mentioned that he basically lived in his own little world and thought that there was no need for bipartisanship. Personally, I think our nation was built on bipartisanship. Without it, we get nowhere. And without us working together, we will go nowhere. It'll be the end of us. So that's basically where I look at it. And if that caller doesn't like government interference, let his house catch on fire and see if the fire department shows up.
Robert, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Let me get one more. Alexandria in Burlington, Vermont. Alexandria, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what do you think?
Well, I think that people who are stuck to their ideals on one side or the other, who say it's my way or the highway, act as though they're children who stomp their feet and hold their breath until they get what they want. And just like anything based in reality, the truth isn't always on one side or the other. It's in the middle. And so if you refuse to come to the middle, you're never going to achieve anything or find the right way because you're stuck on your side.
What do you say to those, Alexandria, who think the middle has just gotten off track? And you've got some on the right who think that, some on the left who think that, who think the center of the debate isn't near where the country ought to be anymore.
I think we should look at history and not just our country, but other countries and see what has happened to them when they veer off into one specific direction or the other. You know, things end up happening to those countries that inevitably pull them back towards the middle so that they can prosper and their citizens can have lots of rights, but yet not feel infringed upon by their government.
Alexandria, I appreciate your call. And if I may, let's get one from Dick Lugar's territory, Ivy in Indianapolis, Indiana. Ivy, you're on the air with Senator Dick Lugar.
Yes. Hi, Senator Lugar. This is Ivy. I've worked on your campaign, and I've been a big supporter of yours in the past, and I was a Republican because of your bipartisanship. So I, you know.
What about now, Ivy? Are you still a Republican?
Well, technically I am, but I don't like most of the Republican candidates because they don't want to give anything. They don't like women. They don't like gays. They don't like pro-life. They don't like, you know, I mean, you know, it's just crazy.
Senator Lugar, what do you think of the way your party has gone in recent years?
Well, I appreciate, first of all, Ivy, and I'm glad that she called in from Indianapolis, as well as the previous two callers who are persons thinking along the bipartisan index way. But let me just simply say that obviously we think from day to day about the problems, and I just talked about the farm bill and problems of farmers. Let me just mention, when I was chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, I had the good fortune of working with Claiborne Pell of Rhode Island, and then for a long while with Joe Biden of Delaware, and then with John Kerry of Massachusetts, as either the chairman or the ranking member of the committee when I was chairman or ranking member. And we agreed, fortunately, that the face of America to the rest of the world cannot be a 9-8 vote, or it cannot be sort of zero and no vote at all. Now, we really have to come together, and we have got to spend time on that, in making a statement about our national defense and our national security. I think these are absolutely critical problems, and they do require people, however, having the will to talk to each other and to do so not just occasionally, but year after year in behalf of our country.
Are you pointing a finger at which party, if you're going to look at the two, is more to blame for this lack, this recession of cooperation, Senator?
No, I'm not. And I believe if we were discussing politics in the country and taking a look at the spectrum from the far left to the far right, we would find members of Congress representative of the far stretches on both sides, and a good number of members in their parties who are very delighted that is so, that they really like to have somebody who, as a matter of fact, is at the extreme. My hope is, however, that most Americans, particularly if they come out to vote, if they're taking a look at politics at all, and this is a big if, we've had primary elections in Indiana recently in which only 20% of the people voted, maybe 30% at the greatest number. This is not very much of a public. So this means that very frequently, particularly for members of the House of Representatives, where there have been districts that have been so-called gerrymandered, mm-hmm. they're drawn in a way in which the one party or another is bound to win. The whole contest really is in the primary election, and frequently the most extreme persons have the most enthusiasm if there is absolutely no vote. And so we're getting some strange results of that sort. Even if we are getting strange results, I'm saying finally, our bipartisan index offers an incentive to members who know that they're going to be called out on their ability to reach across the aisle, to be effective, to offer any bills at all, that somebody cares about this and somebody is going to publicize their activities.
One more from Indianapolis here. Marcia, you're on with Senator Lugar. Thank you for calling, Marcia.
Senator Lugar, so good to talk to you.
Thank you, Marcia.
All of your contributions to our city and state and country. I think it is the billions of dollars of special interest money by ideologues that is driving these deep divisions in Congress, and that bipartisanship won't return to Congress until we have complete public financing of federal elections, no op-outs.
Dick Lugar, what do you say? Marcia, thank you for your call. Senator Lugar?
Well, I certainly share Marcia's feeling about the excessive spending. It is truly outrageous, and there is no stopper to it. Once the Supreme Court ruled literally that unlimited sums of money can enter into political campaigns, unlimited sums have been entering, and now we're going to set new records of this sort. This just means that points of view of particular groups that have their own scorecards, or even individual persons who want to control the presidential nomination. This is really an outrageous situation. However, the chances that it will change very fast are not very good. And this is why some of us are better off for at least some meanwhile situations like the bipartisan index, so that there is at least some discussion of this while all this spending is going on. It's very hazardous. As a matter of fact, for bipartisanship. But at the same time, we better be speaking to that issue and the degree of cooperation to get our nation going.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today with longtime Indiana U.S. Senator Dick Lugar, 36 years in the U.S. Senate. Now he's at the Lugar Center, out with a new bipartisanship index trying to rank and thereby put pressure on American politicians on Capitol Hill to work together to get things done. Of course, politics keeps on rolling. Today, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, South Carolina, announcing his bid for the 2016 Republican presidential nomination, stressing his commitment to countering threats abroad. Here was Graham earlier this morning.
Simply put, radical Islam is running wild. They have more safe havens, more money, more capability, and more weapons to strike our homeland than any time since 9/11. They are large, they are rich, they're entrenched. As president, I will make them small, poor, and on the run.
Senator Lindsey Graham today, Richard Lugar. Lugar worked a lot on foreign affairs when he was in the U.S. Senate. We'll ask him about policy abroad. Let's get our listeners in as well. Buffalo, New York. Josh, you're on the air with Senator Lugar.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Senator Lugar. It's nice to be able to voice my take on it with you guys. My view is the word bipartisanship. Everybody focuses on the partisan being the bad part. My view is it's the bi, which is the issue. We only have two parties, and when there's two parties, we're going to be stuck indefinitely in a rut. We need more, more voices to the table, more sides that can be as effective. I mean, it's always a center when you're, it's a poll from the left to the right, but there's also an up and a down and, every other direction that should be addressed to. I'm not a fan of the Tea Party, but I'm glad to see, another aspect to the table. And I think that they are...
Blow it open a little bit. Get more players in there, more parties in there, though. So far, the Tea Party is kind of worked for gridlock, in some ways celebrated that as a way to stop government. We heard that in this hour. Josh, let me hold that and get one more for the Senator. Patrick in Burlington, Vermont, you're on with Dick Lugar.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Senator Lugar. I'm curious if I think we probably want to take a more historical view about what's going on. If we talk about bipartisanship, this isn't some sort of abstract idea. This is something that's really grounded in political reality. And the reality is there are no more Rockefeller Republicans anymore. The Dixiecrats are gone. So much of the 20th century's political parties don't look anything like they do now. They're much more homogenous, and they really resemble European-style and even Canadian-style mm-hmm. political parties, which are very rigid. They're very ideologically homogenous, and this is increasingly what voters either through polls, like the voting booths or the opinion polls, want. So really, I think, sure, an index may be good as a stopgap, but shouldn't we be considering a change to our actual systems of governance now that our parties and increasingly the public want something else? Should we, I think, like the previous caller, be exploring what, a true multi-party system would be, where if you, the voters vote people in, they actually have a majority or can at least form a distinct coalition to get things done instead of the kind of stalemate we have here.
A kind of multi-party future sounds almost parliamentary. Dick Lugar, how about it? Has the bipartisan era run its course? Does it, without Rockefeller Republicans and conservative Democrats, Dixiecrats, doesn't work, says our caller?
Well, my judgment is that it's best that we have two strong parties, one of which may have a majority and therefore is able really to bring about some effective governance of the House or of the Senate. Absent that, going into coalition governments, conceivably one of the major parties or the other picks up the third party or the fourth party or what have you in the coalition and really continues to govern on that basis. But it doesn't seem to me that this is going to change really the effectiveness of governance in the country. It may bring about representative of more special groups that are heard in that respect. I believe that our best bet still is to work with two parties. And within those parties, however, the caller makes a very good point that more and more of the leadership appears to be at the extremes as opposed to what might be called the middle. I'm not necessarily advocating centrism or middle ground. I'm advocating really people from wherever they may be in the parties thinking about the best things for America, thinking about new ideas that would be a part of policies and legislation. that they formulate and that they try to gain a majority of support for. And I'm trying to have an index that illustrates how effective members are in doing this, as opposed to simply shout-outs. That is not effectiveness, in my judgment, although some would say that's what I came to Congress to do. I think we really have to have people who may start from anywhere on the political spectrum, but who carefully study, listen, understand the rest of the world and the rest of the country, and formulate policies and gain the support for it to move America forward.
You know, it sounds nice when you put it that way, but it's been a lot of years now. I mean, your own numbers show you go all the way back to the 90s and you had some very strong, maybe some of the strongest hyper-partisanship there. How long can we go on in this sort of semi-paralyzed, polarized state? Where does the, you know, where does the trouble come? Where do we hit the rocks if you think that's where we're headed?
Well, we don't want to really test that out, but clearly we hit the rocks when our budget situation comes to conclusion and the government literally shuts down. This is a dangerous world for a government shutdown, as a matter of fact, while you're trying to prove your point. Or we really are going to be in difficulty if we're unable to think through treaties with other countries. Currently, a very strong movement is afloat to try to get a trade treaty with Asian countries. That would be very important in terms of our leadership in Asia vis-a-vis China or anybody else. It's a foreign policy problem as well as an economic problem and a job creator. But you have many people who say, I've never voted for a treaty. I've never voted certainly for a trade treaty, quite apart from an arms control treaty. When I was working with former Senator Sam Nunn of Georgia on the so-called Nunn-Lugar Cooperative Threat Reduction Program, we had many people who said, not a dime for the Russians. Now, the fact is that we wanted to spend American taxpayer money to take down the Russian missiles, to take off the warheads, to destroy these weapons that were aimed at the United States, over 10,000 of them that could have annihilated every city and every place we had. And yet, even in those days, the bipartisan effort of Nunn and Lugar did not have unanimous support, because many people said, first of all, not a dime for the Russians, and secondly, I don't believe in arms control. I would believe, as a matter of fact, we simply ought to build more weapons and outgun the Russians.
We've just got a minute left here. What about the Iran deal? Are you for it, Senator Lugar? You worked a lot on foreign affairs.
On balance, I favor it because it appears to be the best we can do at this moment. By that I mean that if we are able to delay the Iranian nuclear program, if we're able to get adequate inspectors in to make certain we know what is going on, or that we would have at least a year's adequate warning if the Iranians cheated on the subject and began to move again the other way. I'm for it because I believe it does offer a potential opening for diplomacy with Iran. I don't have great optimism about that, but I believe that we have an opportunity here at a time that we are attempting in the Middle East to combat ISIS, and very clearly in the case of Iraq now, the Shiites militia are the most effective fighters. The Iraq government for the moment is so dissolved in three parts that it's really unable almost to move. So it's a very strange political situation, but for the moment, the Iranian negotiations seem to me to be constructive.
Former U.S. Senator from Indiana, Dick Lugar, still watching the world and watching this country very closely, out with a new bipartisanship index hoping to encourage bipartisanship. We shall see as he holds that yardstick up to those of his former colleagues still on Capitol Hill. Dick Lugar, thank you very much for being with us today. Thanks for your work.
Thank you, Tom. I'm honored to have been with you.
In a moment, a Senate showdown over the Patriot Act. This is On Point. A last-minute deal did not happen. When the clock struck midnight, key provisions of the Patriot Act, including the law that authorized the government to collect bulk phone records, expired. It was a big victory for Senator and presidential candidate Rand Paul,
But the battle over the Patriot Act is not over. To help sort through the current circumstance, we turn to Dustin Volz, correspondent for the National Journal. Dustin Volz, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
So ultimately, why did this falter?
Well, it faltered for a lot of reasons. So as soon as the calendar turned to June, the three of the Patriot Act's spying powers expired. And as you mentioned, that includes the power that allows the NSA to collect, you know, virtually all U.S. Phone records, call metadata. And this is a combination of Majority Leader Mitch McConnell sort of jamming the calendar here, trying to deal with it at the last minute and thinking that he could sort of convince his caucus to not accept reforms. And then Senator Rand Paul, who's running for president and using this as a big campaign issue, saying, no, I'm not going to let anything go forward. I'm going to use all my power to basically slow down the progress in the Senate, where one senator has a lot of power to make things really go very slowly. And he basically forced a lapse here, a temporary lapse of these authorities.
Dustin, how do you read why Mitch McConnell was so determined to keep the current wording of the Patriot Act rolling over into the future?
It's a good question. McConnell was repeatedly characterized by his critics as isolated on this issue because this reform measure, known as the Freedom Act, was supported by the White House. It passed the House overwhelmingly with 338 votes last month. Democrats and Republicans were behind it. But McConnell and some other defense hawks in the Republican Party, including Senator Marco Rubio, who's also running for president, have said basically, why change a program in any way that can maybe jeopardize national security? And this is the way that debates happened before with the Patriot Act reauthorization. We've gotten very close to the deadline, and people sort of relent on their objections, and with the fear of national security in their eyes, they agree to an extension. And I think McConnell, knowing that history, tried to do so again, but he maybe overplayed his hand a little bit here. And I think it's also clear that he underestimated the resolve of Senator Paul and a few others who really said that we're not, after the Snowden leaks emerged 2 years ago, we're not going to let this law go forward unchanged.
We had, of course, John McCain speaking in support of the program, I guess, as it's been carried out. Here he was on the Senate floor yesterday.
Isn't this program as critical as it's ever been since its inception, given the fact that the Middle East is literally on fire and we are losing everywhere?
People pulling out the stops on the language here, and then Rand Paul himself blocking the extension of those provisions of the Patriot Act, saying, what about our freedom?
Are we going to so blithely give up our freedom? Are we going to so blithely go along and just say, take it? Well, I'm not going to take it anymore.
And for the time being, he's not. The so-called Freedom Act out of the House, is this what would move these records or keep them at the private companies and then force the government to request them with a judicial sign-off each time, Dustin?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Tom. This would, depending on who you ask, it's either a distinction without a difference or it's a major change. The NSA will no longer be collecting all these phone records every day. They'll have to go ask the phone companies for them on an as-needed basis with approval from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court.
Is that a big deal or not? What's your estimate of that, Dustin? Does that put a real speed bump in front of them, or can they just as easily reach into the private companies' data banks and pull out the same material?
Well, the NSA director Mike Rogers has said that this is something they support. That this is a system that will not undermine national security. Other senior administration officials and President Obama have said this will not slow down the process in a way that hurts them. And it's also important to remember that two review groups commissioned by the president found that this bulk records program was ineffective. And also, it was ruled illegal last month by a federal appeals court. So this reform bill does a lot of things, and one of those is sort of clear up the legal messiness of the Patriot Act, maybe not actually authorizing that program to begin with. And it looks like now the Senate is going to vote on it maybe as soon as Tuesday. If they don't amend it, then it'll go to the president's desk. But McConnell, sort of in another last stand here, he has offered some amendments to weaken the bill. And if any of those get passed, there could be some more legislative ping pong going on here between the two chambers, meaning that the expiration of the Patriot Act could continue for some time.
ruled illegal, not effective according to these studies, and yet McConnell putting everything down there on his, as you call it, his last stand. It brings me back to the question of why. Does he think that this is going to be a good campaign issue for Republicans in 2016, or does he just think it's that important to have direct NSA monitoring of all Americans' phone records?
Well, it is fascinating. As you mentioned, there was so much opposition to McConnell here, and he's not one to talk openly with reporters about his thinking. He is known to be a grand strategist and able to use the Senate to you know, his bend his will here. But he was very forceful on this issue, and he didn't want to back down until he basically had to. And it's unclear what he's thinking. And but he, even though he's endorsed Paul for president, this is clearly an issue that McConnell disagrees very strongly with the fellow Kentuckian on.
Does it seem as though we will end up with some version of the Freedom Act passed by the House already?
Absolutely. I think that is the most likely scenario here. It advanced for debate in the Senate yesterday overwhelmingly. It's just a matter of, you know, is McConnell going to get some of his amendments to weaken the bill or not, and how long this process will drag out before it finally reaches President Obama's desk.
And for right now, as we speak, the NSA saying we're not doing the monitoring that we've done?
That's what they're saying. They've shut down the program. They shut it down late last night, and they are no longer collecting these phone records. So, as one person put it to me earlier, it's Phone Freedom Day for those who don't like the NSA.
Dustin Holtz with the National Journal. Thank you very much for being with us, Dustin.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.